100.9 Belfast.
Support for Belfast Community Radio comes from our listeners and from the Old Professor's Bookshop, a Harvard Square bookstore in downtown Maine, featuring a unique selection of scholarly and rare new and used books. Located at 99 Main Street, open 10 to 4 most days.
Hello, hello, it's Ellen Sander, host of Poetry Woodshed Radio. Not your ordinary poetry hour full of readings, recordings, spoken word, commentary, quirk, and quintessential poetry love. For the connoisseur and the merely curious, we have the classics, the contemporaries, the beats, the geeks, the jammers, and the slammers. So join us right here on WBFY.
Poetry Woodshed's hours are Wednesday at 7 p.m. and Saturday at 11 a.m.
Welcome to Books and Writers, the show for writers, aspiring writers, and anyone fascinated with creative writing. I'm your host, Spencer Stevens. On Books and Writers, we'll talk with those who know writing as both an art and as a science, who know how to make writing work, how to get it noticed, how to find inspiration, and how to avoid ruts and get out of them. We'll discuss habits, habitats, and brains of writers, editors, publicists, book bloggers, bookstore owners, publishers, and others. We'll talk about the books that should have succeeded but didn't. We'll talk about the writers who broke the rules and succeeded anyway. We'll look at books in progress. We'll lead you to becoming a better writer, or at least to a deeper appreciation of your favorite writers. Welcome to Books and Writers. I'm your host, Spencer Stevens. Our guest this week is Maine author Jim Nichols, the only writer to win the Maine Literary Award for Fiction twice. Before the interview, this news. Among the new books by Maine authors is O. William by Elizabeth Strout. Elizabeth Strout revives her character Lucy Barton from her earlier and very popular novel, My Name is Lucy Barton. Also on the list of new books by Maine authors is Winterland, Create a Beautiful Garden for Every Season by Kathy Reese, photographs by Lisa Look, published by Princeton Architectural Press. Also in the new book category, Oslo, Maine by Maine author Marcia Butler, published by Central Avenue Publishing, described as a complex tale of fractured families. The Belfast Free Library is sponsoring a poetry contest for kids and teens. Deadline for entry is the 30th of November. Entries can be any style poem about something you're grateful for. Drop your entry off at the library or send it by email to L. Mary, that's letter L, M-E-R-R-Y, at belfastlibrary.org. On the calendar, Robin Wood, author of The Field House, will be appearing in person on the 17th of November at 7 p.m. at the Vos Library in Union, Maine. The presentation will be available via Zoom. If you go by the library, they'll give you a link. You can also email librarian at Vos, that's V as in Victor, O-S-E, library.org. The Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance is sponsoring some upcoming events noteworthy for writers. First, Talking About Writing, How Podcasting Can Help Your Craft, a presentation on how writers can use podcasts and how they can study them as well to learn better storytelling, how to craft conversation and connection with readers. The event is scheduled for the 26th of February, 2022. Registration is available at the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance website at mainewriters.org. The Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance is also sponsoring an upcoming event, Perspectives on Non-Traditional Publishing, a seminar on how indie publishers can be negotiated with and approached. The seminar is offered on Zoom, scheduled for Saturday, the 20th of November, 2021, at 10 o'clock a.m. Again, for details, go to mainewriters.org, the website maintained by the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance. Our guest this week on Books and Writers is Maine author Jim Nichols. Jim is the only writer to win the Maine Literary Fiction Award twice. Jim grew interested in fiction writing while working as a ticket agent for a commuter airline, Bar Harbor Airlines, in Rockland. Born in Brunswick, raised in Freeport, Jim has worked variously as a bartender, a pilot, a skycap, taxi driver, fence builder, orange picker, as a travel agent and as a dispatcher for an air taxi service. His writing draws from his many experiences, and it's appeared in numerous regional and national magazines, including Esquire, Narrative, The Clackamas Review, American Fiction, River City, and Night Train. He's been nominated several times for the Pushcart Prize, which is possibly the highest award available for writers of short stories. Nichols lives in Warren, Maine, with his wife, Anne, and their two rescue dogs, Brady and Jesse. They have two grown sons, Aaron and Andrew. Jim's most recent novel, Blue Summer, came out in August 2020 and is published by Island Port Press. This is one of the two novels that won the Maine Literary Fiction Award. Welcome, Jim Nichols, to Books and Writers. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you, Spencer. I'm glad to be here.
Jim, let's talk first about your most recent novel, Blue Summer. You won the Maine State Fiction Award for that, and it's a tremendous story. I know from having read it myself, and as I recall it, it's about a fellow who suffers a tough upbringing, lots of abuse, becomes a musician, and that sort of that combination of things dictates a lot of the rest of his life. The trauma from being abused and the investment in being a musician. Have I got the story essentially correct?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think. I don't know if he was really abused as much as it was his sister that his stepfather sort of focused on.
Okay.
And he was sort of a defender of his sister more than an abuse sufferer himself, I think.
Okay, all right. I'm curious, let me ask the question you probably get with most interviews. Where did the idea come from for the book? What was the inspiration?
That's a good question. It started out as a short story, and the short story was about a musician who had had a tough upbringing and was faced with a return to his childhood home, and he was sort of a struggling guy, as the novel character is. And he had to find the wherewithal to actually go home and face up to that. And then everything else sort of sprang from that short story and that image.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of turning this from a short story into a novel, was that your own, or did you get encouragement from somebody else?
No, it was my own. It actually started as a short story and never was completed as a short story. As I worked on it, it just kept expanding itself, and new characters began to appear and lead me in different directions, and so kind of a matter of following those characters around.
Sure, sure. I guess it happens a lot that you start on writing something that you think might be short or long, and it ends up being very different.
Yeah, I mean, you start out with an image or an idea or maybe a bit of dialogue or some visualized action. I'm sure you know.
Oh, yeah.
And then you just sort of go where the characters take you.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in your mind it's a short story, but it doesn't, you know, I remember when I was trying to write it as a short story, these characters would appear and try to sidetrack me and lead me off in different directions, and I would get rid of them after, you know, under revision and try to go back to my original concept, but they were stubborn, and finally I gave up and you know, let them have their head, so to speak.
Yeah, sure. Have any of the characters or events from Blue Summer come from your own experiences, from your own life?
A lot of the stuff from Cal's early childhood, when he, you know, when everything was good before his father died, a lot of that is similar to my childhood growing up in Freeport, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a much larger family than Cal did, but my father was a musician who played the piano and trumpet. And in the book, he sort of splits off into, Cal's father, real father, and his sort of faux uncle, who were both musicians. But a lot of that, the 4th of July in the small town, a lot of that stuff, I think, sort of represents my childhood.
Did you lose your dad at a young age, or is that part just that was just fiction for the book?
No, I just recently lost my dad at age 97.
Oh, holy cow.
Yeah.
That's a long life by anyone's standards.
Yeah, he is quite a guy, an old Hellcat pilot in World War II, and a musician, as I said.
Did the Blue Summer story have any special personal meaning to you, other than it was a book that you wrote?
It has relevance to my father, I think, and in that he was kind of a taciturn Yankee type who really could express himself musically, kind of like Cal himself, who speaks to his sister musically. And I can remember my father, when my mother died, which 20 years before him, I can remember hearing him play what was their song on the trumpet, sort of a raw, really sort of heartbreaking way.
It sounds like he certainly put some emotion into that sort of, into his art. I'm curious about your publisher, Island Port Press. What makes them a good publisher, and how did you come to pick them?
Well, they became my publisher sort of through a random submission process. I had bundled up some short stories to send around to publishers while I was working on the novel, and Genevieve Morgan, who's the fiction editor, senior editor for Island Port, called me up and had some suggestions about improving the, saying that they were interested in it, but they wanted it to be reconstructed as connected stories.
Yeah.
So it was really just sort of a, random slush pile response. And that's how I hooked up with Island Port. But they're a very good small publisher, and they are really interested in producing art from, Upper New England, Maine in particular.
Yes.
And spreading the word. Their motto is, "We tell stories."
Yeah.
And they make really good looking books too that appeal to me. That's sort of why I sent them the manuscript in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been through their catalog. I like their cover art, and it does look like Maine writers are very well represented among their clients.
Yeah, the publisher is from Frenchboro. He's an old Maine, from an old Maine family. His name is Dean Lunt, and the Lunts have been lobster fishermen for a long, long time up that way.
And was Blue Summer your first project with Island Port, or your only project so far, I should say?
It's my second book with them. The first one was came out of that collection of stories I sent them.
Yeah.
In 2014, I guess. And after I reworked it, they published that as a novel in stories called Closer All the Time, which, by the way, also won the Maine Fiction Award.
Yeah.
The books.
I can't say I know of too many folks who've won the Maine Fiction Award twice. Let me ask, because you probably know better than I do. Has anybody else, to your knowledge?
I'm the only one. However, I'm sure that won't last, because some of the past winners, like Richard Ford, for example, or Monica Wood, I'm sure they'll be up on the podium again.
Yeah.
But I'm the first.
Yeah, well, congratulations. That's quite an accomplishment.
Thank you. I'm quite proud of it.
Did you do other projects for during the time that you were writing Blue Summer? Did you have other projects going at the same time, or are you the kind of writer who just focuses on one thing at a time?
Mostly the latter, although yeah. I wrote a short story for Island Ports, a little glossy magazine that they published for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote another piece about my brief little relationship with John Prine mm-hmm. after he passed away.
Yeah.
Also for their magazine.
Yeah.
Or for their website, I mm-hmm. guess. But mostly just work on what I'm working on.
Yeah. I've always admired the writers who can interrupt the production of a novel and put together a short story or do some other project before they go back to the novel. I find that extremely difficult. It sounds like you do it. I'm curious. Is it difficult for you, or do you glide between the two?
I don't do it a lot. I would say it's probably a little on the difficult side to you can do it, but it does cost you some time with your main project if you interrupt.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Yeah.
Now you
script just interrupt us, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. We've all experienced the interruption for one reason or another, and I guess sometimes it's another project. Sometimes a different writing project suddenly comes along and takes priority.
Yeah, luckily I haven't had to write for income, so
mm-hmm.
I haven't had to. I know a lot of writers do other kinds of writing for a paycheck.
Yeah,
and to me that must be very difficult to have deadlines interrupting your work in progress.
Yeah,
I've been lucky in that regard. I always had a job that allowed me time to write.
And you were able to work at your own pace, it sounds like.
Yeah, yep.
That's a nice thing. It is something of a luxury to be able to determine how fast or how slow you want to work and not have to worry about somebody looking over your shoulder.
Yeah. In one way, that's a result of, not being... maybe as high up in the food chain.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, if you're working, I can work at my own pace, which tends to be kind of slow.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't be if I was with a major publisher.
Yeah.
Or, had a high-powered agent pushing me or whatever the scenario might be.
Yeah, yeah. And Jim, you were not born into a writing family or born into a network of writers. You came to it honestly through your own interests and cultivating those interests. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, in the way that I know you mean it.
Mm-hmm.
Although I did, my family, which was kind of a big, chaotic, boisterous group of nine kids, were quite literate. My parents were very literate, and we were always writing stuff. But as far as, writing for publication and MFAs and writing programs and things like that, mm-hmm. I'm an outsider. I'm an outsider as far as that goes.
Yeah. I'm curious, growing up in a literate family, have you used your parents or your brothers and sisters as beta readers ever? Is that part of your program or no?
I have shown... I have one brother in particular who's also a writer. His name is John Nichols, and he's produced, written, produced, directed, and acted in maybe 20 plays set in, produced in Portland.
Yeah.
John had quite a following as a playwright and also wrote fiction. So I've run stuff by him before.
Yeah.
And I've sent early stuff to my sister Julia, who's an artist,
mm-hmm.
A painter, but also has the same sensibility, you know, the creating type sensibility.
Yeah.
But mainly my wife Anne is my main reader.
Okay. I can't tell you how many writers I've talked to who've said my spouse is my main beta reader. That happens all so often. It makes me happy that so many writers have apparently happy marriages.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how lucky it is for the spouses, but
true. You
know, they're sort of captive audience, and they, yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
and likes to do it, though.
Yeah.
I'm sure the rest do too.
Yeah.
To help them.
That's a terrific resource to have.
Sure.
Tell me about your effort to improve your own writing. Is it something you do consciously and deliberately? And how do you go about it?
Not so much anymore, but when I was starting out as a short story writer about 30 years ago, I did make a conscious effort to try and improve my writing. And we talked about this earlier, I think. But one of the ways that I did that was to take short stories that I admired and type them out in manuscript form, as if I were composing the story. And in that way, it sort of forced me into a close reading of what this other writer did and how he produced that story that I admired.
Yeah.
I thought that was a great learning process.
Yeah. As you typed out these stories, I suppose the dialogue or the pacing would reveal itself to you and would give you the opportunity to learn something. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, it's a wholly different look or a different read than just reading the story for itself as a story.
Mm-hmm.
If you type it out, you're going so deep into it. You know, you're getting every word, every punctuation mark, every paragraph, and it's just it's really, I think it's you just soak it up much deeper than if you're just reading a story in an anthology or something.
Sure, that makes perfect sense.
I think you learn much more typing a story than you do reading a story.
Sure. Is this advice you give to younger readers very often? Is this something you talk about ever?
Yeah, I have before.
Mm-hmm.
I've suggested it as a means to improve your writing.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, just reading other writers is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing what they're up to and how they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after you find one that you really like and you go to type it in a manuscript form,
mm-hmm.
you're just entering a whole different level of understanding.
Yeah. And how do you pick the story that you... How did you pick the stories that you were going to type out? There must have been some criteria you applied.
I pretty much just followed my nose on those. I would always read the annual anthologies that come out, you know, the best stories of... You know, 1995, best short stories, or the Pushcart Prize collection.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go for prize-winning stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would introduce myself to different writers that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I found Ray Carver, Tobias Wolff, Alice Munro, people like that.
Yeah.
You know, Richard Ford, too, he wrote a collection that I read way back early on.
Mm-hmm. And in looking over that volume, that annual volume of best short stories, did that guide you at all and for places to submit your short stories? Did that play a role?
Yes, absolutely. At the in the back of all of those anthologies, there are lists of publications where the stories came from.
Mm-hmm.
And not only the published stories, but the honorable mention stories, they would also they listed the authors of all the honorable mention stories and the publications.
Yeah.
So that was very helpful as far as, you know, seeking out places to submit your own stories to.
Yeah. you know, I'll admit I often have a copy of the best short stories from America for a particular year in my nightstand. I'll read one or two stories before bedtime. And yeah. It's interesting what it feels like I'm learning about the editor of each volume. The one I'm looking at now has Stephen King as editor. And they've had some celebrity editors in the past, Ann Patchett and Garrison Keillor and some other folks. I'm wondering if you gleaned anything at all from the patterns in the stories rather than just from the stories themselves.
I'm not sure about that, although I always read the editor's comments in the beginning of the anthology where he mentions why he chose the different stories, which he mentions.
Yeah.
Why a certain story was chosen and what resonated about the story.
Yeah.
I always found that informative.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear your take on the short story as an art form. Are there things about writing short stories that seem really important to you, but that don't seem to have found their way yet to the younger, less experienced writers? There must be a few lessons in there.
Yeah, I think so. That you learn only by writing them and seeing what works and what doesn't. But very important is that you have to grab the editor's or the reader's attention in the first paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're submitting those stories around, you have to realize that the editor who's going to read it has 100 other stories piled up on his desk waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a cruel fact, way of the world, the writing world, that they will use pretty much any excuse to get rid of one of this huge pile they have to get through by Friday, So if the writer doesn't grab them right off, then, you know, there it goes back in the self-addressed stamped envelope.
Yeah, sure.
On its way back to you.
Yeah.
And I saw this firsthand when I was an editor myself of an online magazine that Francis Coppola produced called Zoetrope, All Story. And I had to go through that pile myself. So I know of what I speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing is that everything that you leave in the story, it doesn't matter in the first draft, you just write as much as you can to get to the end. But when you revise it, you have to throw out everything that doesn't move the story forward in some way. It might be a beautiful sentence, you know. The old phrase is you have to kill your babies.
Yeah.
And you have to throw away some good stuff if it doesn't move the story.
Yeah.
Everything has to be, has to be an organic movement toward this inevitable end.
Yeah. On the subject of grabbing an editor's attention right away, are there any generalities or rules of thumb that you are able to divine?
One would be don't be cliche. That's deadly.
Yeah.
You know, another one is don't be a performing monkey.
Yeah.
So you don't want to do, literary gymnastics for the sake of showing off for an editor, because they don't like that either.
Yeah.
But they want to know that you have something to say that's concise and elegant without being showy. You basically just have to boil it down.
Distill it. Yeah, I think sometimes if a writer works too hard at sounding good, it works against them. It sounds clumsy somehow or awkward. Is that your observation as well?
Yeah, and too authorial too, because the story's the thing. You know, the author's not the thing. The story is the thing.
Yeah,
and if you make the author the thing or the writer the thing, then you're going to lose some people. They don't want to see how smart you are.
Sure.
They just want to read the story.
Yeah. that they want to take in the pleasure of the words rather than the author's extreme effort to be considered clever.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious, Jim, have writing workshops or similar events played much of a role in your development as a writer?
Not a lot, no, although I've been to some. There was one called the Molasses Pond Writers Workshop that early on, around 1990, I guess, when I was starting out, I went to a couple of times, and there really wasn't much instruction, but it was nice to get away and be, you know, in a cabin on a lake up in Millbridge, Maine, and get together with other writers to discuss each other's stories.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some, you know, critiquing that went on, but mainly it was just a feeling of community,
mm-hmm,
and of legitimacy that you got from being among all these other writers.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that was really, trying to think. I went down to Simmons College for a week with C. Michael Curtis, who was the editor of the Atlantic's fiction editor.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to apply for that and get accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it was kind of a cool thing to be chosen.
I'd say.
To participate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when I got there the first day, he read my story to the class. And
mm-hmm.
said, you know, this is the quality of work we're looking for. So
wow,
that was a big sort of affirming.
Yeah, no kidding. Did you ever get any work published in the Atlantic or come close?
I don't know how close I came, but I tried for a few years.
Yeah.
And you know, Curtis would always say, "This one isn't the one, but keep trying." And
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm pretty sure you'll get there. And but I never quite did.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I know. Early in your career, you managed to get a story published in Esquire, which is the kind of publication that'll get your work noticed. And from an earlier conversation we had, I know that was pretty pivotal in your career. I'm curious if you could tell us a story about how that happened.
Yeah, that's happened mainly because Norman Mailer took an interest in my writing and sent along a note with a story of mine to Esquire and suggesting that they publish it.
Mm-hmm.
The story about getting Mailer interested in my writing was he used to fly out on that little airline, Bar Harbor Airlines,
mm-hmm.
that I worked for. Back in the 80s, he would fly from Boston up to Bar Harbor, where he had a summer home, I believe,
mm-hmm.
or he rented a home. And the plane would stop at Rockland, where I worked, on the way through. And one time when it stopped, I sort of accosted Mailer on the plane and gave him a short story that I'd had published in a little magazine.
Yeah.
And just asked him to read it. No pressure. I said, I would like to know that Norman Mailer read one of my stories.
Mm-hmm.
Just leave it in the seat pocket. When the plane comes back through, I'll grab it out of a seat.
Mm-hmm.
When he came back through, when the plane came back through, the magazine was not on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
About a week later, when he flew back through, he came out of the plane and, you know, looked me up at the office there. And
yeah.
Asked me if I'd give him something a little more ambitious
mm-hmm.
to read. At which point I pulled a manuscript out of my pocket because I knew he was on the plane.
Yeah. Oh, so Norman, I just happened to have this in my pocket.
Yeah. And he laughed and took it back with him and wrote me a note when he got back to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And that was when I got the note saying you should send this to Esquire.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And I think Norman wrote an opening or a preface to the story that got published in Esquire. Is that right?
Yeah, he wrote a little introduction to the story, saying how we'd met at the mm-hmm. little airport, and I'd accosted him, and you know, saying a good result from these kind of encounters is not to be expected, but this one worked out all right.
Yeah, wonderful. And outside of the Norman Mailer and the Esquire story, do I take it that your short stories were submitted to literary magazines and so forth in a conventional way, just mailing it in and saying, you know, hey, here's something that you might want to think about publishing?
Yeah, exactly. I would send them out to, a few magazines at a time, and just to have, I like to have things making the rounds. I got quite a few of them published. I won some prizes, some national prizes with short stories.
Yeah.
And all that helped me moving forward to get other stories published.
Yeah. And you told me one thing when we spoke recently that really caught my attention. You actually would pick up a literary magazine and read stories from it to see if the style was one that you thought would work for you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I would start with the anthologies, as we discussed earlier. And if I liked a story, I would see where it was published, and I would order I would spend $5 for a copy of the magazine. Which is sort of a fair thing to do also if you want them to consider your work.
True, yeah.
So I would always buy a copy and read it and see whether I thought it was, my stuff would work with them.
Yeah. It sounded to me a little bit like market research, making sure that you were sending your stories to places that you thought would be receptive, given the kind of stories you were going to submit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's so subjective. And the editors have their own minds. If there's no sense wasting your time in sending stories, no matter how good they are, if they don't fit into what this particular editor likes, you're not going to get anywhere. So what, you can narrow the odds a little bit.
Yeah.
Just by researching.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it wouldn't do to send science fiction stories to a journal that was interested in gender issues or in dystopian worlds of the distant future or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
How old were you? I'm curious, when you got your first short story published, about how old were you at the time?
It was in my late 30s, mid to late 30s.
Yeah. And did you feel like you had turned a big corner, or was this just a hobby for you at the time?
No, I was serious about it once I started. I wanted to be good at it, and I wanted to get them published. I wasn't looking to write stories, to give to my friends or siblings. I wanted to get them out there in the world. And felt quite paternal about the whole thing.
Yeah, sure. I think a lot of folks have that paternal feeling towards their work. It's something you love and want to protect, I suppose. Tell me about the zoetrope position with Francis Ford Coppola. How did that come about? That's quite a publication he does, and I would imagine you have to make quite an impression to become editor.
I joined the workshop. It was one of the first online workshops around. I joined it just so I could see another way to see what other people were writing.
Yep.
And to get people to read my short stories that I was writing, and just discuss writing and that sort of thing. And as a member of they rated your stories. I had a high rating, and that's how I think they got interested in me as a possible editor with this online magazine that they were going to start producing.
Yeah.
They chose me and a gal named Mayor Freed. And so we were the founding editors of the magazine.
Oh, at the very beginning of it.
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. So this Okay. Zoetrope's been around for a while. It's grown into an amazing publication. I go to that quite often. I imagine you feel a bit of pride when you think about having a stake in the organization.
Yeah, I do. They don't produce the online magazine anymore.
Okay.
The print magazine, yeah, that's quite an impressive publication now.
Yeah.
Darn right. Well, it has been pretty much from the beginning.
Yeah. And I'm going to guess if you're an editor of a publication like that and you're receiving dozens, maybe hundreds of stories in a month's time, you must see some patterns among the folks who aspire to get their short stories published but don't quite make it.
Some of, as we discussed earlier, some of the show-off type of writing.
Yeah.
You see quite a bit of that. Another one is another thing that you see quite often is stories similar to well-known stories.
Mm-hmm.
Themes that. I'll tell you one thing that you see sometimes that horrifies every editor if they get to the end of the story and find that the main character wakes up and realizes it was all a dream.
So let's note to self, don't do that.
Yeah. No, that's one that they'll immediately run into their fellow editors and show it to them.
Yeah.
I got another one.
That's kind of hilarious. I like that. It sounds like you are firmly in the school of thought that says if you want to write, you probably have to be reading, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You have to know what's been written before, historically, not just contemporary, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you really have to know, you know, what's been written by past masters and then work your way up to contemporary writers and see what they're doing, or maybe what they're not doing.
Yeah.
And see if you can figure out, you know, type a few up, see if you can figure out what they're doing.
Sure. Was a large amount of the reading that you did in the realm of short stories, or was it more books or a combination?
When I was writing myself.
When you were working on the whole idea of reading to become a better writer, did you focus on short stories or on books or on other formats?
On short stories. Mm-hmm. And also books of short stories.
Yeah.
Because that's what I was trying to write at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, it took me about 10 years to get a book published.
Mm-hmm.
I started getting stories published within a year or so, which is pretty fast.
Yeah.
And then took me about 10 years of writing, of publishing short stories to get that first collection of stories published.
Yeah.
And that was with Carnegie Mellon Press.
Mm-hmm.
2003.
Yeah. And do you have any works in progress these days? Do you have a next project coming out at some point?
I have a first draft of a novel that I'm sort of picking up and working my way back into.
Yeah.
I've been in a lazy stretch after, post-publication lazy stretch.
Yeah.
But it's just probably really about time I've started buckling down again. I do have the first draft done, so I've got a head start.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us anything about that project, or are you too early in development?
Well, it's sort of... It has a bit of a connection to Blue Summer in that it's about cab drivers in Portland, and I kind of briefly in Blue Summer talk about Cal leaving his little town and going to Portland and driving a cab while he works on his music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he might make he's not in the first draft because I wrote it before I wrote Blue Summer, but I think he might make an appearance as a secondary character anyway.
Yeah. And I think you told me that you had been a cab driver at one point. It sounds like you maybe took a few episodes from your life and turned them into this novel that's now in production.
Yeah, I was a cab driver for a while in Portland, and did it for a few years. And yeah, it's quite a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like. It sounds like. I wanted to back up for just a minute to the story about Norman Mailer. You know, going out to introduce yourself and to give him a piece of your writing takes a certain amount of confidence. Was that a difficult step for you, or did it just happen quickly enough that maybe you didn't think about it?
No, I was kind of pushy about it back then anyway. So I would I was moonlighting as a bartender at the Samoset Resort. And I would bring stories into work with me and hand them out to regular customers at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
To ask, you know, and ask people what they thought.
Yeah.
I remember there was one guy who used to come in and order a martini and a short straw. One day he came in and I could tell that he'd rehearsed this, but he came in and asked for a martini and a short story, and then he looked at his watch very ostentatiously and said, "Oh, damn, I don't have enough time. Better make it a beer and a vignette." He was proud of himself for that.
Yeah. Good
but anyway, it wasn't really anything. It was a little nerve-wracking to approach Mailer, you know, with his reputation.
Yeah.
As being a kind of a grumpy guy.
That's what I've always heard, yeah.
Yeah, he was great, though.
Yeah. But pushing through whatever apprehension you might have had led you to a pivotal moment in your writing career, it sounds like. That was a big moment for you.
Yeah, it was. I mean, he wasn't the first one I'd approached. I'd had conversations with Jimmy Baldwin at that same airport.
Yeah.
A few others. Pretty much anyone that came through that I knew as a writer, I would walk up to and say hi, and, you know, at least shake hands.
Yeah, sure.
But Mailer, being Mailer, like present day Hemingway, pretty much, couldn't let him go without giving him a story.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like you're of the school that you've got to be direct and bold about approaching people. That's a good strategy for a writer who wants to meet folks.
Yeah, I think if you do it right, yeah, you know, it can be okay.
Mm-hmm. And did you and Mailer manage to stay in touch after that episode?
We did. We corresponded right up until sometime before he passed away, you know, maybe a year before I got the last letter from him.
Mm-hmm.
But he gave me a blurb for my first book, my collection of stories.
Mm-hmm.
He hooked me up with his agent. That didn't last a long time, but it was nice of him to do.
Yeah.
And used to send me drawings. Mailer always liked to do line drawings.
Yeah.
Can I swear on this program?
Yeah, go right ahead, sure.
He sent me one that was titled Fuckface Farinucci. And it was a drawing of a head.
Yeah.
A face whose every feature was the number 7 or the number 3.
Yeah.
And I got a bunch of drawings from him, copies of drawings. And, you know, we corresponded about whenever I had something good happen, I'd write him and he'd write back.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah, I'd say so. I could see you enjoying that quite a bit.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it was like having Hemingway as a friend.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Very excellent. I'm glad you mentioned the agent thing. That was something I wanted to ask you about. You decided in the end to forego an agent when you were pursuing publishers, and I'm interested in your thoughts on that. What led you to that conclusion, and what were your experiences working with an agent?
Well, I only had the one,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't a great experience. Although he's a nice guy and all that,
yeah.
But it took so long to get a response.
Yeah.
You know, he would only send it to one publisher at a time.
Yeah.
And sometimes it would take months to get a to get a rejection.
Yeah.
And then you'd have wasted, you know, all that time. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel that he was, he sort of lost his sense of commitment. At first he was very eager to, you know, on Mailer's say-so to hook up with me.
Yeah.
And he liked the novel that I had written back then. But his interest waned when he got a few nibbles, but nothing. When it didn't sell, anyway, mm-hmm. after about a dozen submissions, which took, you know, 3 years.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, maybe two and a half.
Yeah.
So after that, I decided I was done with agents, mm-hmm. and I would submit to small presses instead of big presses and just worry about getting a book published.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd probably 5 years after I ditched him mm-hmm. is when I caught on with Carnegie Mellon.
Sure. And your work with that one agent, was that the collection of short stories, Slow Monkey?
It was a novel.
Okay. All right.
I had written. I figured, you know, now that I was an Esquire, I'd better write a novel and get that out there. So
yeah.
So that's what I did.
Okay. And this was a novel that became Closer All the Time?
No, actually, this was a novel that just grew old in my desk drawer.
Yeah.
It was actually an early novel about cab driving in Portland.
Okay.
So I'm sure some of it carried over into the one I'm working on now.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think a lot of writers have a story in the drawer or more than one. That's a common phenomenon.
Yeah, I have three, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in the drawer, really?
Yeah. I wrote a couple of mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of for fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I didn't even know if I don't think I even submitted one of them, but anyway, it's all good writing practice.
Sure. Jim, I'm wondering about submitting to small presses. Have you learned anything about which kind of writers are best suited to small presses and which ones might be better suited to going with an agent? Is it possible to draw any conclusions from what you've seen and learned?
Maybe. I know that a lot of the rejections that I got from my first novel were because the editor thought it was too quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I some very complimentary rejections, but said this is too quiet for us. And I think maybe small quiet goes to small presses.
Yeah.
And maybe if you're, I don't know, if you have a bigger canvas, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm more interested in characters than in big, loud, noisy plots.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe that makes a difference.
Okay. When you talk about your writing being quiet, is that the opposite of being sensational, or am I reading that incorrectly?
Yeah, I think that's probably a good way to put it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, a lot of...
A quiet writer that has achieved a lot of success, someone like Kent Harouf, if mm-hmm. you've ever read him.
Mm-hmm.
I read one recently by a guy named, it was called Cargill Falls. Have you read that?
I have not, no. Who's the author?
I'm trying to think. Wycheck, I think his last name is. I can't remember his first name.
Yeah.
But that's a kind of a quiet novel, but and Kent Harouf's stuff is quiet, but they've achieved quite a lot of literary success. I don't know about financial success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious, since you're so well read on the short story front, which of the outlets for short stories that are on the table today do you most enjoy? I'm curious which ones you like and maybe which ones you find inspiration from. What outlets?
You know, I pretty much only read short stories in the anthologies these days that mm-hmm. we talked about earlier.
Okay.
That's where I find them, the best short stories of of the year, mm-hmm. and the Pushcart prizes, things yeah. like that.
Yeah, okay. Very, very good. Well, Jim Nichols, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today. It's been enlightening, it's been interesting, and it's even been good for a few laughs in a few places. You've been very generous with your time.
Well, thank you, Spencer. It was a real privilege to be on with you. I'm happy you thought of me.
Hopefully we'll get a chance to speak again, Jim.
Hope so.
All right.